Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest may have stumbled upon the question of our time. But what if we were wrong? It's not just a great question, but it's the name of Chuck Klosterman's new book, But What If We Were Wrong? Thinking about the present as if it were the past. The book challenges our assumptions and guides us and asks questions like, how much of history is classified as true simply because it can't be proven false? Chuck Klosterman is a best-selling author. He's also served as the ethicist for the New York Times. He's also one of the founders of the website Grantland, and he's essentially written for every publication known to man. Chuck Klosterman is in Chicago for a talk at Chicago Ideas Week, and he's my guest tonight at the big table. Chuck Klosterman, thanks for being here.
Hey, it's great to be here, and the table is big. You're not lying to your audience.
We brought out the big one for you. Yeah. I really, really enjoyed the book. I really feel like this is a groundbreaking moment for me to question everything that I knew to be true. So let's start there. What I wanted to start with was just the concept of the book overall. And what I really liked was objective wrongness. Explain objective wrongness.
Everybody can be wrong in their personal life. They can make a mistake in a relationship or a mistake at a job, and they're wrong about what they believe. But I'm very interested in the idea of collective wrongness, things that we're all sort of wrong about, that they don't even really – a question that doesn't seem like a question because no one's even asking it.
Right.
It's just sort of to be assumed. Now, in terms of objective wrongness, I think what you're probably talking about is sort of the difference between being wrong about something that is, in theory, objective, like science or math,
right,
something that is really totally data-based and doesn't seem to be made to be flexible, as opposed to subjective wrongness, which is like how we look at art. For the most part, we assume that we're going to sometimes be wrong about art and the way we view it, and culture and the way we perceive it, but the stakes are lower because, you know, what does it mean to have a wrong opinion?
Right, it's an opinion. It's subjective.
Yes.
Right.
I mean, there is a consensus, of course, and as we move forward along the timeline, that consensus sometimes kind of galvanizes into what seems like a real hard truth that isn't that different than objective truth. But there is definitely a chasm between those ideas.
What I really enjoy about this book is I feel like, not unlike the greatest philosophers of our time and ancient Greece and along the way, that this is that kind of book for now. In the way that there are a lot of things that we just take for granted or we assume is truth here. And I'm not talking about news stories or even theories about sports teams, things like that. We're talking about things like gravity. Hmm. Like where they like the idea of where this kind of stuff – you use that as a great example, gravity, because there was a time when gravity was not thought to be the gravity that we know.
Well, I mean, that is kind of in some ways the origin of a lot of how this book sort of unspooled. One of the first people I interviewed for this book were some sort of like high-profile scientists, one of them being Brian Greene. Was kind of like a rock star physicist, a string theory guy. He appeared on an episode of The Big Bang Theory. And the way whenever I just had a conversation with anyone like this is I would go in and I would frame it like this. I would say, I'm not trying to contradict your view of reality because in all likelihood, your view is my view. I don't know anything that you don't certainly and you know way more.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just asking, what is the possibility or the likelihood that some of these fundamental core beliefs could be eventually perceived as absurd as the way we believe things from the 1400s or whatever. And then to be safe, I was like, no, I know some things are off the table. Like I know gravity
right.
is not really up for debate. And he said, well, no, it's not. That's not true at all. In 500 years, our view of gravity might be completely different. And that's when I thought, like, this book might work. If the thing I'm using is the unchangeable idea is actually changeable, I guess everything really is on the table. But, you know, it's a crazy thing. Like, our view of gravity really – or the modern view of gravity, let's say, starts kind of in the 1600s with Isaac Newton. It's about 350 years old. But for about 2,000 years before that, the belief in gravity was based on Aristotle, which is a period when science was interlocked with philosophy more than math. And what Aristotle believed and sort of what became the general belief was that like a rock doesn't float because a rock wants to be on the ground. The rock has agency. It desires to be on the ground. It wants to be in the center of the universe. And of course, Earth is the center of the universe. So the center of the Earth is the dead center. So a rock is trying to get to the center of the Earth and the soil is just stopping it, you know. Now for 2,000 years, we laugh, right?
Right. But that was the belief.
Yes. But that lasted about 2,000 years. So our current explanation and understanding of gravity which is, like, again, Newton and Einstein, basically, 350 years old, much more sophisticated and much more nuanced, but it's not like the people in the previous period were like, we have this idea about gravity. We know it's crazy. It's like it made sense to them. It seemed reasonable.
No one questioned it.
Yes.
Until the apple fell and hit the head, if that's what happened. No one was questioning gravity and the properties of gravity.
So, I mean, I guess there is sort of a larger question above this. It's like, what is the benefit of questioning gravity? Like, does it make more sense to just say gravity as we know it is real? Or does it make more sense to say, well, I'm 99.9% certain our understanding of gravity is accurate. The second statement obviously is safer, but if you open up the window to be wrong about gravity, you're essentially opening up the window to be wrong about anything, and that shifts the entire perception of reality.
You know, I was going to save this till later, but I guess it applies here. I mean, you go out of your way at the end of the book to talk about the idea that this is, it's not necessarily dangerous, it's detrimental. The concept of not asking questions or just this concept. Talk about that.
I didn't want to somehow suggest that we're really putting ourselves at risk by using sort of whatever limited technical abilities or mental facilities we have to understand the world. There's no huge risk. It's not like we're putting our society in jeopardy. However, I feel like the sense of certitude that seems to accompany intellectual life now and intellectual discourse, this idea that in order to sort of appear intelligent, you almost have to be fascist in your belief in your own ideas, that, for lack of a better term, is just kind of annoying. It makes life a worse way to be. It doesn't have to be that way. Like, you can express an idea and say, this is what I believe, this is my reason for it. You don't have to also add, and if you disagree with me, you're an idiot. Or somehow the conversation we're having is not sort of an exchange of ideas, but me hammering your ideas away. I just think that there's something socially detrimental in the level of certitude that seems to exist in this culture, which, you know, I'm only 44, but it seems to have pretty radically amplified in my lifetime.
Yeah. Chuck Klosterman is the author of But What If We Are Wrong? It's thinking about the present as if it were the past. Chuck's in town for Chicago Ideas Week. We'll continue our conversation here on The Download in just a second. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio at the big table, Chuck Klosterman. He is the author of But What If We Were Wrong? Thinking about the present as if it were the past. Chuck Klosterman, former ethicist for the New York Times, also a best-selling author and founder of the website Grantland. And you've written for pretty much every publication in New York City.
Seems like it. Actually, that's not true. There's some I still haven't
hit. You got to get working. Yeah. Before we went to the break, we talked about the idea of gravity and questioning. And we talked about that objective wrongness. On the other side was the idea of art where, you know, and you used the example of Moby Dick, this book that everybody knows to be the greatest piece of literature. And when somebody makes a comment like on a Yelp page or whatever, like, I really hate this book, they're almost seen as contrarian. Their opinion doesn't necessarily matter because it's going against the grain that everybody, even though maybe I hadn't even read the book, thinks it's the greatest thing.
The knowledge of Moby Dick makes that kind of negative review seem pretty performative.
Right.
Like, it doesn't seem as though this person is taking a cold reading of Moby Dick and being like, I came across this book. There was a whale on it. Seemed cool to me. I read it. It's not very good. I mean, the person knows what they're doing, that they're establishing this position that doesn't have any impact on the canonical nature of Moby Dick. Like, Moby Dick is in a canonical silo. It doesn't matter what people really say about it now. That's just sort of reflecting something on the critic. But, I mean, the trajectory of Moby Dick is just an interesting situation. I mean, like, Herman Melville writes this book. He believes it's going to be his masterwork, his masterpiece.
This is mid-19th century. Yeah.
And, you know, the book comes out, and it gets mixed reviews. And it doesn't really sell that great. And he had been a commercially viable author before, but this was a pretty devastating blow. I mean, basically ended his career as a writer. He was a poet for a while after that, and you know, an alcoholic. He worked in the customs department, and he kind of died very depressed, the way it seems. And then after World War I, many years after his death, the book was sort of rediscovered and reinterpreted. And it wasn't now just a good book, but it was the book. Like, it was the great American novel. Now, when people use that term, what they're really talking is about a text that sort of reflects the idea of what Moby Dick did to the culture. And, you know, now so the question becomes, why did that happen? Well, on one hand, there's sort of like if we were in a literary class, they would say, well, you know, these guys went to World War One and they came back. And they had had this experience fighting kind of a like almost a faceless enemy that they didn't really relate to, you know, the idea of Germany. And they had this brotherhood among soldiers. And they had to learn all this technical information about guns and war strategy. So they get a book like Moby Dick where they're fighting this whale, which sort of symbolizes the unknown enemy. And they have the Brotherhood of the Sailors, which reminds them of being in the army. And, you know, Moby Dick has whole sections in the book on, like, how to tie knots and stuff like that. Like real technical minutia. But a guy would be like, that sort of reminds me of putting a gun together or whatever. You know? Now, that's sort of like the rational explanation we use. But in truth, I think it's probably far more arbitrary than that. They needed a book to represent this. This is the book that got selected. So we reverse engineer this explanation as to why it happened. This is not in any way to criticize the content of Moby Dick. It is a great novel. But did it have to be that novel is the question. Did Melville have to write about whaling? He had experience as a whaler. What if he had climbed a mountain? Could that have been the plot? What if he had been, you know, a sheep herder or something? Yeah. Could that have been the premise? It's almost as though we need certain things to occupy different spaces in the culture. And something has to have enough merit to get in that conversation. But once it's in the conversation, then it's almost like a random, capricious experience. It's like something is going to be selected by chance, but we can't feel like it's chance. Mm-hmm. We don't want to say we love this novel because, you know, we're going to love something. So then we make up the explanation, and I think so much of art history is based on this.
That's, I mean, you take on history in this book, and there's a whole great chapter on the past. And the theories, and you get into what conspiracy theories are, but theories, but the concept of what we know as our past, as our history, as our human history, may just be a complete fabrication. There are theories out there that Attila the Hun and Genghis Khan were the same person, and we just continually cycle the same stories as a way to, as you said, like almost like as a placeholder.
Yeah. And it's not as though I'm saying believe all conspiracy theories. Most conspiracy theories are wrong.
Right.
But what happens is this, you know, we come to these conclusions based on a limited amount of information that's in many ways impossible to verify. We can use things that seem to supply verification, but it's not like a hard verification. So they become difficult or really impossible to contradict, because if you contradict those ideas, you're using the same kind of flawed data.
Right.
It's not as though we have, you know, a history based on shaky ground, and then we have this real solid ground that upends it. It's like it's both shaky. So the story that everyone is familiar with just becomes more and more galvanized. And, you know, here again, what's the problem with this? Is there a problem if it turns out that our understanding of Attila the Hun is false or whatever? Well, I guess not. But that just tells us that, like, our security in the present is not that great. And the way that our period of time is going to be viewed is not going to be the way we think we're seeing it. Yeah,
that's so good, man. You're blowing my mind here.
Well, that's my job. To go from radio station to radio station and blow skull fragments across the booth. Yeah.
Chuck Klosterman is the author of But What If We Were Wrong? Thinking about the present as if it were the past. He's in Chicago for a talk at Chicago Ideas Week. We'll take a quick break for the news. When we come back, I got to ask you about dreams. That's a big part of this book. And also, as a culture, how we do fill in those blanks. And that seems to be, you know, as we've been explaining in the first half here, just about that it's almost a need for us to be able to fill in blanks. And we kind of just go along with it. I'm fascinated by it. Chuck Klosterman, my guest here at the Big Table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio at the Big Table, Chuck Klosterman. He's the author of But What If We Were Wrong? Thinking About the Present as If It Were the Past. Klosterman, of course, best-selling author. He was the ethicist for the New York Times. So many credits to his name. This book really is, to me, you're breaking culture. That's what I love. You're breaking human culture. I love I'm in love with this book. All right, so let's talk about the dreams. You had a great passage in the book with Richard Linklater, you know, just a phone conversation with him about so many things about the past, about but really about astrology versus dreams. And I really thought that was something that we ignore dreams as sort of like a flippant thing that happens in our subconscious that we explain to our friends at breakfast, the joke in there. And, you know, and we believe in astrology as more, you know, why you and I are aligned.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's something that Richard Linklater brought up. Now, he's, beyond being one of my favorite directors, he's had two movies, Waking Life specifically about dreaming, and also Slacker has aspects of this too. But we were just sort of talking about the idea of how dreams are perceived, okay? You know, there was a time long ago when dreams were – their importance was much, much greater. They were believed to be ways essentially to like – to astrally project ourselves into different worlds and different realities. And then even in the early 20th century, you know, with Freud and Jung and stuff, I mean, dreams were a big deal. Like Freud was a dream head or whatever, you know. And then it slowly started to kind of crumble, this idea that dreams were important. Some guys at Harvard realized or claimed or argued, however you want to look at it, that dreams were really just electrical impulses in the mind. This is true. But what their kind of claim was is that the content doesn't matter much. Like some people even feel that like the narrative, well, way dreams appear, you know, that's something that's not happening at all. We just sort of construct that to explain what has happened in our mind, these leftover thoughts or whatever. So now we're kind of at a point where dreaming is not taken seriously. Like we just – nobody – if somebody wants to talk about their dreams, it's kind of seen as an annoyance. And yet part of me wonders, okay, a third of our life is spent in this metaphysical world that we're creating, and that there are certain aspects of dreams that do seem oddly – universal. Many, many people across all cultures and across all time tend to have dreams of losing your teeth.
Right.
Like that's one of many dreams, the flying dream.
Right.
All
going
things,
out with your pants off or whatever.
So sometimes I wonder, are we underrating the importance of dreams simply because we have no valuable way to study them? Like someone can tell you what they dream, but you can't get inside their skull and see what it looks like. So it's not something that can really be in any way studied in a serious sort of reasonable manner. So it's almost because it's impossible, we've elected to decide it's just a waste of time. And I wonder if there could be a future world, people who have not yet been born, who really change their opinion on this. And they're like, this is a real critical part of the experience of being alive. This is like something that maybe is central to how our brains are built, you know? And if they'll wonder if we really were wrong about our willingness to discount something like this. And then Richard Linklater, who loves dreams, is very much in that corner. I mean, he, you know, he loves dreams.
It's fascinating too, because as you point out in the book, you know, astrology has become this thing that people really believe in. They map the stars.
Although I think there is an explanation for why that is. Okay, I think one explanation is that it's a little bit like science, because you're looking at stars and there is an element of hard reality there. But also there is sort of a commercial benefit to astrology. I mean, you know, you can be an astrologer in the newspaper or online or whatever, you know. You can sort of build an industry around this thing that people seem to be attracted to, partially because I think that as society changes, we lack those universal experiences. You see this on the internet when somebody dies and the rush to all sort of collectively mourn. I think part of the reason that happens is because, you know, there used to be only three television networks, so everyone was watching The Tonight Show or whatever. There were these things that all people were doing, and you felt a little bit like there was a collective society. And there's less and less of that as things proliferate. So we look for opportunities where things can be shared. And in a weird way, astrology really is a big shared experience. If you're born in June, this is what your life is like. You know, I think people like that.
They do. There's so many more things. I mean, obviously, you had a piece about rock music you pulled out for the New York Times. The other one I thought was really interesting was the chapter on color. And you used the example on the internet not too long ago about the dress, whether it's gold and white or blue and black. I think that's what it was.
It was
Yeah.
I mean, it was just, you know, for people who don't remember this, they'll be like, what are you talking about? Everybody who does will be like, I remember those 3 days when everybody was obsessed with this idea. This woman said, my mom was going to get this dress or something for a wedding, and we can't figure out what color it is. And everyone, you know, I remember the night this happened, my wife was looking at it, and she's like, I don't understand what the joke is here. Like, she was looking at the dress. She's like, I don't get why people are pretending this is not, like, whatever she
blue
believed
or whatever. Yeah.
And then I looked at it and I had the opposite reaction, and she really thought I was just being a jerk, you know. But then we kind of looked on the internet and realized that this was happening everywhere. Like marriages were breaking up over this. And there was a evening where I think that there was a real sort of unease that maybe we were all seeing the color blue differently, and maybe we always have, and maybe this dress somehow fell on the perfect optic line where some people could see it as blue, and then some people could see it as something else. And it kind of harkened back to this argument that actually has quietly existed forever. Like when Homer would write the Odyssey or whatever, he consistently described the color of the ocean as the color of wine, wine red, okay? That the ocean was the color of red wine. Now, generally, the ocean is not the color of red wine. Also, he was blind, so it was like somebody was telling him this. But regardless, it made people – it's this ongoing question is like, did we use a different sort of criteria for color in the past, and does our perception of color actually change? Like, will people in the future consider orange to be different than what we consider orange? It feels like this should be static. It feels like what we think is the color purple should always be purple. But here again, it doesn't seem to be. It doesn't seem like that's...
And it's fluctuated, like you said, with the wine, and I think it was Aristotle again. Aristotle's made a lot of mistakes.
Yeah, well, Aristotle's the smartest guy who was wrong about everything.
Right.
You know, but I mean, like, he would come up with, you know, Aristotle had an idea of, like, you know, why is the sky blue, okay? Aristotle's theory, now this is just based on observation, and based just on observation, it's a pretty good one. He believed that, like, well, the air is slightly blue. But in the same way that, like, a glass of water seems clear but a well seems dark, that if you get enough air lined up against each other, that slight blueness sort of blankets each other and the sky looks blue. Here again, if you know nothing about the sky and nothing about science and nothing about light refraction, that seems brilliant. But it's not how it is, you know. But you see, he was the best mind of his time. So we now assume the best minds of our time, these guys must be right.
Right. But I think that's the takeaway, is that you know, the best minds of our times, we assume them to be right, but in reality, they're probably wrong.
Well, anybody can be wrong, I guess, is the big thing. I mean, probably a lot of what they're saying is right, but not necessarily everything. And also, there's no harm in wondering that. Like, there's no big mistake or some kind of cultural flaw in admitting that your perception of reality might be wrong. And I don't know why people are so unwilling to do that. I actually find that as I've gotten older, I now realize that, you know, I was more intellectually confident in college when I was dumber. Part of getting smarter is realizing that
you can be wrong.
Mostly. That I can mostly be wrong.
Mostly be wrong.
And that means I'm just self-aware. Yeah.
Chuck Klosterman, the book is called But What If We Were Wrong? Thinking About the Present as If It Were the Past. The book is out. Chuck is in town for Chicago Ideas Week. I can't thank you enough. This book is great, and it was a great conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here.
You bet.